Blog Talk Radio.
February 8th, 2011, Washington, D.C. Planet Earth, third planet from the sun. I'm your host, Dr. C. Robert Jones on the C. Robert Jones Conservative Radio Show. Oh boy, I tell you what, it's been a very busy busy day today. Yeah, that's Let the Rain Come Down by Tony Childs. I think that Tony is like a one-hit wonder, a South African artist who came out with a couple of albums, and I think this was the only one that really hit it big. And I think the year was 1986, I think. All right, let's get right down to it. Obama's 1979 and how it relates to today. Are the wages of magnanimity to our enemies and the snubbing of our allies once again coming due? That's the question for tonight. That's the burning question, given this past week's events. Obama's deer in the headlights, finger in the wind. I can't believe this is happening to me. Initial reaction to Mubarak's implosion has eerie precedence. After the debacle in Vietnam, Watergate, the Nixon resignation, and the Ford win buttons, voters were willing to bet on the smiling, toothy, but unknown hope and change reformer, not from Illinois, no, but from Plains, Georgia. Jimmy Carter's campaign and his early presidential speeches on resetting foreign policy, well, they sure sounded uplifting from what I can recall. They were certainly a rebuke to the supposedly dark Nixon-Kissinger real politic and cloak and dagger intrigue. Indeed, Carter's election marked a return to Wilsonian idealism that predicted American support for other nations on shared commitment to human rights and UN values. Secretary of State Cyrus Vance exuded probity and almost seemed to suggest at every stop that he was not Henry Kissinger. Now, Carter's new America was to entertain no more mindless reductionist inordinate fear of communism, nor would we continue to be a cynical arms merchant to our allies and profit from the tools of death, anti-communism, anti-fundamentalist, strongman modernized, well, modernizers like the Shah of Iran. My daughter just walked in here and gave me a kiss. Where was I? Anti-fundamentalist strongman modernizers, like the Shah of Iran, were suddenly antithetical to American values. In contrast, his radical Islamic enemies were little more than curious and confused intermediaries whose appreciated opposition to dictators would soon be eclipsed by serious European-like socialist reformers. While Carter's America occasionally worried about the communist consolidation in Vietnam or Central America, these rather violent sorts certainly had legitimate grievances. Given our prior support for anti-communist authoritarians, and in fact, the new United States under Carter worried far more about our own SOBs in Africa and Latin America than about the less well-groomed AK-47-toting liberationist. And then 1979 came around, and the unfortunate wages of a well-meaning Carterism became all too apparent after only the first 2 years of its implementation. Does this sound familiar? The world of our Cold War allies proved not to be one of Machiavellian evil and good, but was revealed as complex and consisting of shades of both. It was perhaps good to press our friends in Argentina, Central America, South Korea, and Iran to reform, but to what degree? To be consistent, we were then to pressure the Soviet Union, the autocratic Arab oil production world, or communist China, all of which had far more blood on their hands than did the Shah or the South Korean anti-communist to likewise move toward elections and free speech. Worse still, the more Carter spoke about human rights, the more he seemed, in hypocritical fashion, to court the Soviet Union for an arms control agreement, the Arab world for a peace settlement, and steady oil sales, and, of course, China for economic liberalization through formal diplomatic recognition. It almost seemed to the cynical diplomat that if a nation were hostile to the United States, powerful or strategically important, and even with a horrific record on human rights, the Carter administration would romance it as zealously as it would snub friendly countries that were less powerful and had authoritarian rather than genocidal tendencies. Does that sound familiar? The past killing of a few thousand in allied countries warranted far more anguish than the killing of several million in enemy countries. In short, hypocrisy and sanctimonious bullying soon replaced the promise of unbending principle and moral courage. Carter seemed to be harder on our friends than on our rivals and enemies, especially odd since the aggressive war was more likely to come from North Korea than from South Korea, from a radical Arab world than from Iran or Israel, from the Soviet Union's proxies than from our own, and from China rather than from Taiwan. It's interesting how cyclical the world can be, how there's nothing new under the sun, how everything, things that have happened in the past, that old saying that those who do not heed history are condemned to repeat it. I'm paraphrasing because I can't come up with the direct quote. But I came close enough, didn't I? So here we have a president who appeases our enemies and, of course, is saying as loud and clear as he possibly can without shouting it to the rafters that he is not George Bush. But the problem here is that our president's approach simply isn't working. I'm reminded of a time when I was just a little boy. I was somewhat insecure, and as a little boy, I was the oldest of five, and I spent a lot of time, you know, either playing with my brother and just kind of hanging out with him, or by myself because my sisters were always off doing something else, but I wanted to be friends with the neighbors down the street. And so in order to be friends with them, I would go up to them and I'd hang out with them, and they didn't really know me and they didn't really want to hang out with me. So what I'd do is I would share my things with them. I'd share my toys. I'd share whatever I had. And at some point they began to understand that I was attempting to purchase their friendship, get into their good graces by giving them my things. I was very young. I was 7 years old at the time. I'm no longer like that, let me promise you that. And they would take advantage of that. And I wound up giving them everything out of my toy box, all sorts of things, just so that I could pal around and hang out with them. Now, they had no use for me, one way or the other. But I kept sucking up to the other little kids. I lived on a street called 28 East 100th Street in Chicago, Illinois. And I remember that very well. And I learned that lesson as a 7-year-old that you can't buy friendship. You can't just suck up to people and hope that they will like you, because they will not like you and they will not respect you. And the lesson I learned as a 7-year-old doesn't seem to be the lesson that our president has learned yet. That behaving in a weak, submissive fashion to the world will not cause the world to like us. It's simply, the world simply doesn't work that way. America has been, until Obama's presidency, the biggest stick, the biggest guy on the block, the toughest kid on the block. And when you have a president like President Obama and the way that he grew up, and the background that he grew up in, and I know it well, I have 3 books written by, I have the book that he wrote, and then I have books that were written on his behalf. And all of them speak to the same underlying theme. Obama wants to be liked desperately, and he wants others to like him, and he wants America to be liked. And he believes that over the past 20 or 30 years, and even beyond, that America has been a bully, and that America has committed a variety of sins against the entire world, and that part of his job as president is to right those wrongs, is to take his own country down a peg or two. It's one reason why he is the only president who seems to, who does bow down to foreign leaders. And I'm not just talking a head nod here. I'm talking about deep bowels. Like he's looking to see if there's something on his shoe or maybe on the other guy's shoe. Because he wants to give the impression that America is now, this is, we're living in a new America. We're living in a new time where we're not going to go around waving the big stick anymore. And, you know, history, America has been around for a short time, considering that other civilizations, given the magnitude and the longevity of other civilizations throughout history, we've been here just a speck of dust compared to other countries. But we, at this time, we remain, and for a very long time, the biggest kid on the block, the toughest kid on the block. Everybody wants to be like us, and nobody wants to be like us all at once. And Obama believes that we're not a great country, but under his guidance, we can be a great country. And being a great country to him means that we're not better than anyone else, that there is no such thing as American exceptionalism. And what Obama is finding out now in his 2 years as president is that it simply does not work that way. America is respected and feared when America is strong and tough. It's what keeps countries that wish us ill will from simply attacking us and overrunning our country. It's our toughness. It's the fact that we have an attitude that we're not going to take any crap from anybody that keeps the wolves at bay. And Obama has eroded that persona, that aura of invincibility, a great deal in his 2 years as president. We're no longer viewed as the biggest, toughest kid on the block. Obama has no backbone. Obama is not a tough guy. And what we need as a president, what we sorely need right now, is another Ronald Reagan. America misses President Reagan. I miss President Reagan. I remember that the day that President Reagan took office, his first day in office, I was 17 years old. I was a 17-year-old Marine. One of the first acts that President Obama signed in to law was a pay raise for the United States military. And it was a significant jump in pay. That's his first act as President of the United States. Now, it wasn't symbolic. President Reagan had a great love for the military. But not only did it speak to us, the warriors, the protector of this great nation, but it spoke to our enemies as well. It said that, okay, America is back, and we're not going to take any crap from anybody. And here we are. That pay raise said a lot more than we're going to take care of our warriors. It said that we're getting ready for anything. Now, let's talk about lies, damn lies, and unemployment statistics by Dick Morris and Eileen McGain. I found it this reading very interesting. I'd like to go ahead and share it. The drop in unemployment the Obama administration reported for January is totally phony, Dick Morris writes. Real unweighed data showed an increase from 9.1% to 9.8% in joblessness, rather than a cut in the highly weighted figure from 9.4 to 9.0. Wow. Economist Jim Fitzbaum, I think I got that right, head of the Highlander Fund, calls the report worthless, noting that the entire report is seasonally adjusted to be positive, while the non-seasonally adjusted data is just awful. So, could this be why the Obama administration was silent when the numbers came out? While we did not see Gibbs come out during one of his press briefings and tout this fantastic drop in numbers, Obama did not hold a press conference touting these fantastic numbers. No. Democrats didn't point to this number as a show of their skilled efforts at creating jobs and how great the stimulus, finally the stimulus is kicking in. No, it was silent, like crickets. The cricket sound. I wish I had a cricket sound right now, but I don't. But you get the picture. Now, while the seasonally adjusted jobless rate dropped from 9.8 in November to 9% now, the non-adjusted data went from 9.1 in November to 9.8 now. It's the exact reverse. It's a confusing number, and the formula is very confusing. One would need to be a PhD to figure this all out. But the facts are that the number is erroneous. The number does not tell the full story. Now, I know that these numbers can be spun either way. And liberals will say that, well, you know, the number came down and you just want to say that the numbers are no good. You'd say this anyway. You'd say that the numbers were, even if they went up, you'd say something bad. If they went down, no. It's important to understand that the numbers reflect hundreds of thousands of men and women who simply stopped looking for work. And so they're no longer reported any unemployment jobless numbers. The true number of jobless is somewhere around 12 to 13%. Confusing, isn't it? But Fitzbaum calls the entire jobless report a statistical mirage. And of course, Obama achieved the drop in the unemployment rate not by reducing the numerator, the number of jobless, but by cutting the denominator, the total workforce. 500,000 Americans despaired of even getting a job and left the workforce, bringing the jobless rate down. Fitzbaum reports that the net loss of jobs continues to this day with 875,000 eliminated rather than 8,750,000 eliminated rather than 8,363,000, the administration reports. Without aggressively positive seasonal adjustments for the January 2010, the 39,000 payroll increase would have been closer to a loss of 52,000, and I am confused. But the bottom line is 9% sounds good from 9.8 or 9.4. But there were only 36,000 jobs created, or 39,000 rather. This is not good. And every other day when I'm hearing about joblessness and unemployment, I'm reminded of what Obama said in a speech he gave in Florida shortly after he signed the Porculus stimulus bill into law. He said to the folks in the audience that if the stimulus that he just signed into law didn't work and did not hold employment down to 8%, unemployment down to 8%, if it did not work, then he would be a one-term president. Now, I'm not sure if he was just whistling past the graveyard or not, but it seems to me that if that number does not go down, he will indeed be a one-term president. Remember what I said yesterday, and remember what I continue to say. Just because the guy is relatively good-looking and he has a pretty good smile and he's charismatic doesn't mean jack. Because that is a description. The description I just gave, well, that's a con man. That I could be describing any con man on the streets. ever watch the show White Collar on Fox? I think it's on Fox. I watch it. I'm not sure what station it's on at this moment. But isn't Neil Caffey a handsome young man with a great smile? Wears a nice suit all the time. Very charming. Oh yeah. One of the best con artists in the business. Now that's a TV show, of course, but it's true. Bernie Madoff, not a striking beauty, but charismatic. Now, let's talk about something that's very dear to my heart. Ronald Wilson Reagan. On February 6th, the nation marked the 100th anniversary of the birth of Ronald Wilson Reagan, who is now recognized even by liberal historians as one of our nation's greatest presidents. Now, the current incumbent, Barack Obama, he makes a show of deeply respecting Reagan for his extraordinary achievements. I saw a Time cover with Ronald Reagan and Barack Obama standing together. Of course, Ronald superimposed next to Obama with a nice toothy grin, grinning at Obama. Why is the left attempting to sell us on Reagan and Obama of the thought that they would have been buddies? It's absurd. Ronald Reagan and Barack Obama would be so far apart in ideology, it's amazing. But, boy, our con artist in chief really knows how to work the crowd, doesn't he? Because he said that over the course of one of his numerous vacations, he read Ronald Reagan's biography. He was seen conspicuously so carrying Ronald Reagan's book. Wow. That guy is the ultimate con artist. I can't say it enough. Now, as I stated, Barack Obama deeply respects Reagan for his extraordinary achievements. Uh-huh. Obama's goal, of course, are the antithesis of Reagan's. But it is said that he recognizes how transformational Reagan's record was, and he would like to duplicate it. But the thing is, America is a center-right country. America is not a center-left country. It still is, even after Reagan. Now, it's not just Reagan's specific achievements that inspire people today that leaves so many of us yearning for his special brand of leadership. It is also his profound faith in the essential goodness of the American people and the exceptional role the U.S. has been that the U.S. has been destined by the Almighty to play in the world. And Barack Obama simply does not believe that. In fact, Barack Obama has demonstrated that he believes just the opposite. What a load of crap to suggest that Barack Obama is Reagan-esque. I think that after the shellacking that Obama and the Democrats took in November, they are desperate with a massive, giant, bold D to portray Barack Obama as anything but this socialist, Marxist, uber-liberal goon that he is. You see, unlike a lot of people, I don't believe that Barack Obama is brilliant. No, I believe that he is simply a con man. He is a liar. He is just another politician. Only that his idea of what America should be doesn't coincide with what America's history is all about. It was Reagan's profound faith in the essential goodness of the American people that inspired Americans. The great communicator's power came from his deeply held convictions, not from superficial eloquence or con artistry. I think I just made that word up, con artistry. Maybe not. Reagan's words represented his core. There was no sleight of hand in his speeches. He didn't use liberal language to disguise or hide his agenda. He didn't use a teleprompter, I don't think. I mean, are you kidding? Well, I'm not sure if he ever used a teleprompter or not, to be fair. But I would often see him looking down at handwritten notes or holding 3x5 cards or that sort of thing. So I surmise that he didn't. People young and old feel that Reagan had an optimistic understanding of what this nation could achieve and a deeply felt gratitude for how much of what we had done before. Like our founders, Ronald Reagan knew well the underside of human nature. His father was an alcoholic, which scarred his childhood enormously. But Reagan also knew that a society whose institutions, culture, and aspirations were designed to bring out the best instincts, while checking our worst, could achieve what no other society had done before in creating opportunities for innovators and allowing us all, as Abraham Lincoln would have put it, to improve our lot in life. Now, Reagan's presidential achievements bore out his optimism. He knew that if the federal government did its part to provide a more stable dollar and reduce the burden of excessive taxation and regulation, combined with a strong, purposeful foreign policy, that the United States would soar. And that the rest of the world would follow. Now, the Great Depression still occupies an enormous place in America's memory. But astonishingly, the miserable decade of the 70s has largely gone down a memory hole. Even those who lived through that deeply disappointing decade, such as myself, have forgotten how desperate our country's plight was when Reagan defeated Jimmy Carter in 1980. Inflation seemed incurable. Countless pundits pontificated that this disease was the ghastly inevitability of a democracy. And mortgage rates were at an all-time high of 18%, and short-term rates 21%. And that era was pockmarked by three, count them, one, two, three recessions, each more serious than its predecessor. By the time the last of those slumps hit bottom in 1982, unemployment was at a higher level than it is today. The stock market, in real terms, was some 60% lower than it had been at its peak in the mid-60s. The long-term bond market, outside of treasuries, had virtually ceased to exist. And the Soviet Union seemed to be on the rise, having seized Afghanistan, and with communist insurgents set to take over Central America. The U.S. defense posture had become a global joke. Does any of this sound familiar? Didn't I say that earlier during the show that everything is cyclical? But instead of having a Ronald Reagan, which I think we sorely need at this time, we have Jimmy Carter all over again. I mean, Barack Obama. Cyclical. All of what we see happening here today, for the most part, is a repeat of the 70s. Except we're in Afghanistan now, and communist China is set to take over the whole world. And then along came Ronald Reagan, just in the nick of time. But we don't have Reagan anymore. There is no Reagan on the horizon. What we have is Barack Obama, who is no Ronald Reagan. Hail to the no, he is not. Now, four short years later, after Ronald Reagan's first term, he won a landslide re-election victory, carrying every state but one, with the theme that it was morning again in America. The inflation fever had been decisively broken. Millions of new jobs were being created. America's once anemic financial markets were once again robust, and the country had become a dynamic global high-tech leader. What is Barack Obama's answer? High-speed rail, green jobs, and solar shingles. More and more spending. More and more spending. That's Barack Obama's answer. To spend money we do not have. Back to Reagan. And one of my favorite aspects of Reagan's tenure as president, Reagan's defense buildup, and of course his foreign policy, set the stage for one of the most extraordinary events in human history. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, 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 yeah. The U.S. and the free world winning the Cold War against the Soviet Union. Because when President Reagan set things right after 4 years in office, we had all kinds of money. We were, once again, a rich and powerful nation. Are you getting the picture here? With a Democrat in office, we are weaker as a nation when viewed by the outside world, by other countries. We tend to go into recession. Our dollar is weakened simply at the thought of a Democratic president, the only exception being Bill Clinton, and mostly he benefited from a Democrat, Republican-controlled House and Senate for quite some time. So he was held in check. So, without a single shot being fired, the Soviet Union collapsed. Its ideas resoundingly repudiated. Until Reagan, the Cold War was seen as a fixture of world politics destined to last for generations to come. How did Reagan do it, you ask? How? When Reagan took office, the nation's highest income tax rate was 70%. When he left, it was down to 28%. All other tax rates were cut down as well. The tax code was simplified, with numerous tax shelters eliminated in 1986. Reagan understood, like no other president, that high tax rates are a debilitating, destructive force to innovative enterprise. Deregulation, begun by Jimmy Carter, was robustly pursued under Reagan. Despite a usually uncooperative Congress, the growth of discretionary outlays was sharply curbed, a vivid contrast to what has happened in the past decade. Now, Reagan also strongly increased defense spending. He had the Pentagon put our technological prowess to use, and the Soviet Union could not match us. He purposefully and persistently pursued the war of ideas. Boldly declaring that Moscow was the evil empire, he starkly challenged Mikhail Gorbachev to tear down the Berlin Wall. He fought to strengthen Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty, whose oversight board during Reagan's second term was forcefully implemented. As well as the Voice of America, understanding that communism was fatally weakened when it didn't have a monopoly on information. Reagan repeatedly acknowledged how helpful Margaret Thatcher Britain's conservative prime minister and Pope John Paul II, both also transformational leaders, were in marking possible, making possible the destruction of what Churchill had called the Iron Curtain. Yeah. Also, Reagan starkly challenged the United States of America to become a stronger, more innovative, more creative people. He fought to strengthen America from within. And now, as happened in the 70s, America is suffering a malaise. We are being told we must accept a new normal of sluggish growth and high unemployment. Government spending has reached frightening proportions, never before remotely approached in peacetime. America's prestige overseas is pitiful because Barack Obama has moved into Neville Chamberlain mode. Our prestige has been humiliatingly exemplified by the barely concealed contempt with the Chinese government and how they treat us. Many others, Beijing believes the U.S. is in an irreversible decline. Where have you gone, Ronald Reagan? Barack Obama is no Ronald Reagan. Barack Obama is teaching us that we're no longer, or he's attempting to persuade us that we're no longer the greatest nation on earth and that we should, in fact, get used to it. Thankfully, Ronald Reagan's legacy teaches us not to despair. The American people are in full revolt over Washington's and their state and local government spending binges. Tax cutting and tax simplification are in the air. Even President Obama has felt the need to give lip service, because that's all it is, to overhauling our horrific federal income tax code. Our military is highly respected. The American people have made clear that they want our young men and women in uniform to have all of the tools needed to protect us and civilization, as well as the necessary political support to achieve their missions. No one can match Ronald Reagan's eloquence, just as no one could match that of Abraham Lincoln. Reagan's legacy demonstrates that if we have the right principles and pursue the policies that emanate from them, America and then the rest of the world will indeed right itself once again. Let's hope that it's not too late. You know, America is. It's on the verge of ruin. I am 49 years old. I am a student of history from the beginning of time. And I have studied how civilizations, great, powerful, mighty civilizations, come and go. And it saddens me to think that our country, the United States of America, that has been in existence for such a short period of time, is on the verge of irreversible decline. And that there are those who refuse to see it, or admit it, or do anything to stop it. But I'm optimistic as well. For example, Alaska Governor Sean Parnell said Thursday that he has asked his attorney general to advise him on whether implementing and enforcing the federal health care overhaul would put Parnell in violation of his oath of office. A federal judge in Florida two weeks ago struck down the law as unconstitutional in a case joined by 26 other states, including Alaska. A major point of contention is the provision requiring citizens to buy health insurance. And then Parnell told reporters that he took an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States and Alaska, while the Republican governor concedes the issue is expected to be decided by the U.S. Supreme Court. He also said that he has a duty to uphold the laws and wants Attorney General John J. Burns to advise on what that duty is after the Florida ruling. He said, and I quote, "I'm caught between a federal government that says you must pursue this, you must pursue this, and I have the duty to uphold the rule of law," he said. Parnell gave no timetable for receiving Burris's opinion. There's a lot going on in the world. Oh, another thing. Michelle Bachmann. She gives great speeches. Not only is she very pretty, but she's very smart. Another charismatic person who is down to earth, not at all con artist like, folksy, all American lady. Her opinion is, we can't shut this president down fast enough. And I couldn't agree more. Well, I want to thank all who listened tonight and all of those who download my program. Wow, last night's program had so many downloads. It was great. And Tesla helped out a lot with his call. And apparently the show, it was very popular. And I look forward to seeing how many more downloads the show gets over the course of the rest of the week. Thank you so much for listening. God bless you and keep you. And we will talk again tomorrow. Good night.
How are you?
Yeah, I got it. That. How are you doing this evening? I'm doing great. I'm having a pretty good evening. Yeah.